Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey, we're just in a heated conflict over candy corn.
I don't think it was, I mean, I think two of us are in agreement.
Two out of three people agree that it's delicious.
It was a civil conversation. You guys think it's good. I think it's gross.
I don't see how it could be gross. It's just sugar.
Who's on the show this week?
This week I talked to Jessica Pressler. She writes for New York Magazine and GQ, and I really had a good time talking to her. I will tell you guys this. This episode contains what I believe to be the most awkward moment in the history of the podcast.
Ooh.
Now that is something to listen further for.
Wow.
Not going to tell you what it is.
Because some fairly awkward shit has already happened on the podcast.
No question about it. No question about it. I think that I believe I've topped it.
We should do a top 10 awkward moments podcast.
Yeah.
We got some sponsors today.
I called Sean Wilsey Sean Wilson at the end of his podcast. That was awkward.
Put that in the top 10.
Number four.
Yes, we do have some sponsors. One of those sponsors is Warby Parker, who believe that glasses should not cost as much as an iPhone. The whole Warby Parker system is great. They send you glasses, you try them on, send them back, you get glasses, and they are merely $95 with prescription lenses. You're going to go to warbyparker.com/longform. You'll get free expedited shipping and help support this show. warbyparker.com/longform.
Our other sponsor is Tiny Letter. Venerated people at Tiny Letter. I finished the judging for that contest last week.
Yeah.
I was impossible. They sent me 25 people, all of whom were incredibly deserving, and also introduced me to all kinds of new tiny letters.
Wow.
Yeah. My inbox is tiny letter crazy.
Gmail should just have like a tiny letter tab.
I have one. Yeah.
Well, so enjoy your candy corn. It's delicious. And here's Max with Jessica Pressler.
Hi, Jessica Pressler.
Hi.
Thanks for coming to Dumbo. We've been trying to do this for a long time.
I kept getting pushed aside by New York Magazine colleagues with books coming out.
Jerks. Bunch of jerks.
Jerks with their books.
But I appreciate you finally doing it, sticking with me. There were book pushes, and then there was one time that that we were going to do it, and then instead I had a kid.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry about that.
Freaking baby.
Yeah. Fucking books and babies.
Poor timing.
And we were just talking, you were saying you're from Boston, and you looked at my Red Sox hat, which is on the table here, and I know that you're from Boston, in fact, from Marblehead.
Wow. How did you know that?
Here's another thing I know.
What?
When you were 7, you started a magazine.
Oh, right, because I put this on my like weird website URL that like is a placeholder for when I get a real
website. I creepily found
that
weird website.
So, that's excellent. I did.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you put, according to your weird website, you
already
put...
Already super embarrassing.
You put a bunch of seaweed on your friends.
Yeah.
And did like a fashion
spread
for your magazine.
Yeah, we made like dresses out of seaweed. And then I created a photo shoot.
I only found that weird website earlier today, but the question I'd been wanting to ask you, even before I found that weird website, was...
You want bathing suit pictures of me when I was a kid?
Yes. The whole reason I've got you on this audio podcast was to ask you for bathing suit pictures of you as a kid. No, the thing I was going to ask you about was when you were a kid, were you a wise ass?
I mean, I would say that didn't start until I was... No, yeah, I definitely was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I was.
You were born wise ass?
Probably. I read a lot of like James Thurber and like early sarcastic stuff when I was growing up. So probably that got in there.
Were you like a wise ass in all aspects of your life, or only in your magazines where you're throwing seaweed on your friends?
Probably if you consulted my elementary school teachers in all aspects of my life. For sure.
Because there is there's a streak in your work.
Oh boy.
This is not an old boy question. There's a streak in your work of slight wise-assery.
Uh-huh.
Is that fair?
You know, I don't know. I feel like we're hovering on the edge of something that makes me uncomfortable. There's a streak of wise-assery. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't read my stuff after it's done. I hate all of it.
Yeah, but you write it.
I write it.
What are we hovering on the edge of?
I don't know. We'll get there.
Okay.
Is there a streak of wiseassery? I mean, I guess so. Possibly. I don't know.
All right. We'll get there, too. Let's go back. Marblehead, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Making magazines. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer? Was this always the plan?
No. Like, totally not at all the plan.
What was the plan?
I mean, I always loved magazines. My mom had a lot of magazines lying around. She had a subscription to Esquire for some reason. And, you know, I read like Sassy and all of those magazines when I was growing up. But I don't really think that I knew that that was a job that you could do, being a writer for magazines, until like much, much, much later in life. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was growing up. I sort of drifted aimlessly. I went to art school.
Oh, really?
For a year.
What kind of art did you do?
I wanted to be a sculptor, but I was unbelievably bad. And it was like the 90s, so my sculptures are all like doll parts and like kind of like grunge influence.
Like, do you still have them?
Horrible. No, I don't. I don't even have photographs. Thank God the internet like wasn't really a thing. Yeah, I messed around. And then I dropped out of art school because I was bad.
And was that like a tough moment when you like looked yourself in the mirror and were like, I'm not going to be a sculptor?
Not really. My friends, like, by the way, like kids who go to art school are like the best. So I had like the best, coolest friends in school. And they were all like really good. And they were all really committed to their art in a way that I was just like, I'm just aimless. So
just
looking at
parts.
How committed they are, I was like, this is not what I'm going to do. So, now we're just like, I'm just going to tell you the whole story.
Just
like
do it.
Everything.
That's the idea.
So I left and I moved to Ireland and was like a waitress for a few months. And then I moved to Prague and I stayed in Prague for like 2 years and was aimlessly a waitress.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it was super
fun. How old
are you? 19.
Sounds like a good time.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. And there was no internet. So when you went to, I mean, there was, I just didn't know about it. When you went to Europe, you'd like totally disappeared. And so I was like just in a different existence and being like an expat for 2 years. But that like would have gotten weird if I had stayed any longer. So.
Yeah, they're those people who stay too long and then they're not expats anymore.
Yeah. And being a cocktail waitress, I saw those at an Irish pub. I saw those people all the time. I was among them. So then I came back and I was lured by my parents. My dad is a college professor in Pennsylvania, to a small school in Pennsylvania where I had a really great professor in like a writing class that I just randomly took, who then introduced me to the editor of an alt weekly in Philadelphia, who gave me an internship, which turned into a job. And like, what? Now this is what I do. There's actually more steps to that, but that's basically.
Were you writing when you were living your cocktail waitress expat life?
No,
in Prague?
And I really, really should have been, yeah. But I just didn't know. But also, it would have been terrible. It would have been like my sculpture, probably. So it's just as well.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have put it on the internet, so it'd have been fine.
That's true. That's true. No one would have seen it.
I had a similar experience waiting tables in South Africa, and I did write about it, and I'm very happy that none of it's on the internet.
Really?
Yeah.
We almost moved to South Africa, me and my friend, who was also a cocktail waitress in Prague, and then she like broke her ankle and we didn't go.
Oh, but it's a good place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to
leave. I may have never come back from there. And
if you really pin me down, I would say I should not have ever left.
Yeah.
Could have been one of those people who stuck around for too long, was kind of a weirdo.
Yeah, I mean, I like those people. I still do. And by the way, I went back to Prague last year and everyone was still there.
Oh, really?
It was amazing. You would have thought. It's been like 10 years, like,
yeah.
More than that. Like 15 years. Like, yeah, it's crazy.
That must have been fun.
It was awesome. Yeah, it was really, it was kind of a relief. I was like, oh, I'm young enough for everybody to still
be. Yeah, were you like
here.
Reliving your
Some people were dead and some people were in jail. So most people were still.
We're doing fine.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like if you had stuck around, the odds would have been good that you would have ended up okay. Maybe jail, maybe debt.
Hopefully, yeah.
But not writing for all of these huge magazines.
Yeah, so that happened.
So then that happened.
Yeah.
What were you writing about at the Alt Weekly?
Okay, so
was it City Paper or Philly Weekly?
It was Philly Weekly. And the editor there, Tim Whitaker, was really, I think, well, first of all, Philadelphia is like a great town of newspapers. And there were a ton of great writers at the Philly Weekly. And I was not one of them. I did like a lot. I basically did like anything that anybody asked me to do. Mm-hmm. I thought that I would be like an editor. I didn't even know that like long form, as we call it, as you guys are called, was a thing. Mm-hmm. Until I like had a boyfriend that did it. And I was like, I can do that. he acted like all important about it. And I was like, I can do that. That's kind of how that happened.
Before you were doing that, what was the stuff you're doing at Philly Weekly?
I had... this is so embarrassing. I had like a gossip column. I mean, that was some real wise ass shit, because Philadelphia, if anything, I would say that the wise ass thing probably solidified in Philadelphia, because that is like a tough town.
Yeah.
And it's also like super easy to make fun of. Bless them. and they really like encouraged it at the Philly Weekly. Like, they really encouraged you.
Were you like making fun of like city council or like
no,
people hanging out at the bar?
Probably. I mean, probably. Yeah. Yeah. Probably like city council.
And how old were you when you were doing this?
21, 22.
I also worked for an alt weekly when I was 24. Mm-hmm. And it was a crazy thing to write about people and then like actually have them read it and then see them around.
Oh, terrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind of went over the top on that there because I was really encouraged to by my editors. But I also think that like subconsciously I wanted to get out of Philadelphia. And so I was like,
you're just going to burn it down.
I was just going to burn it down.
Is there something like in particular you're thinking of? It's like when you're talking about like going too far, is there...
No, but there was like a tipping point, which is that I wrote an article for the New York Times about Philadelphia. Convoluted circumstances led me to like I called someone on the phone at the New York Times and like pitched them something, and one thing led to another. And I wrote this article and the headline was, "Is Philadelphia the Sixth Borough?" And it was a terrible experience writing the article. Like, it got edited like by like 9 people. I didn't know what I was doing. Like, the editor like had me like interview like her friends and like, you know, the executive editor's friends. Somehow I got, you know, just pilloried for suggesting that Philadelphia was
the
so inferior.
It was the phrase, the sixth borough.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So just completely, basically run out of town.
Yeah.
In fact, last year I saw a guy at Roberta's in Brooklyn and he like yelled at me about it.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was Philly people who were aggrieved by being called the sixth borough.
Everybody was aggrieved. Yeah, New York people were aggrieved, but Philly people were like really aggrieved.
I reread that article today and there's one...
you did? So you were asking. That was a leading question.
No, I was hoping for something from like your alt weekly days where you called someone an asshole and like you had to see them at a bar.
Oh no, that happened like on the regular.
That didn't stick out. It was when you called people an asshole in the Times that it was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's this.
I didn't call anybody an asshole in the Times. It was like super innocuous. And by the way, somebody else, I was quoting somebody when I said it was the sixth borough.
Which is very clear in the story.
Right. But for anyone people can't read, which is the thing that I've learned.
That's actually a major theme of the podcast. People don't read.
They can't read.
There's one turn of phrase in that Times story, which was like 2005.
Oh my God, I can't believe you read that.
Which I really liked. It was like this. There was like this one moment that felt like a Jessica Presser line, and it was like you called Philly a flyover city, and then like it set off in like M dashes. It was like train over, and the rest was all like pretty timesy and straight ahead. But that one felt like a little little Presser dig.
I wonder. I don't know. The whole thing was so worked over.
So you wrote that story and then like got jumped on. Do you think people jumped on you not just because of the sixth borough thing, but because you'd been in the alt weekly like zinging people a bunch?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
If the goal was to like burn it down, that was a pretty great like final knock down the bridge.
I mean, you could look at it that way. Like, drop the mic.
How do you look at it? Yeah. Sixth borough and I'm out. Can never come back to this town.
I really didn't know that I was going to have that reaction. I thought they'd be happy about it. It was like a love letter to Philadelphia as far as I was concerned. I was like, this is, I'm saying it's cool, guys. What? So, that was not received well.
When does this boyfriend writing long articles come along that makes you think you can do that?
It was probably around the same time. Yeah, he was writing, or he was, you know, fairly established magazine writer. And I was like, well, that looks cool. Like, and he got to like travel and go to Croatia and like do cool things and spend ages writing something. And I was like, that seems really like a fun thing to do. So I had actually left though.
You left Philadelphia.
Yeah, I had moved
after New York. The Times.
Yeah, I dropped the mic and I was like later. Yeah. But then I was sort of lured back by Philadelphia Magazine for a little while to do some stuff for them.
From New York.
Yeah.
And then you start writing for New York Magazine.
Well, I moved back to Philadelphia for a year. It's very confusing.
Okay.
What happened was I left Philadelphia, dropped the mic, and then came to New York and was doing like a bunch of like random freelancing stuff, including I had this amazing job at In Touch Weekly stalking celebrities. Like, and it was kind of like the heyday of the tabloid.
Yeah.
And
Gawker stalker era.
Even maybe slightly pre.
Whoa.
And I would like stand outside the Ritz and like wait for Ashley Simpson. And then be like, how's Jessica doing after her divorce? And she'd be like, fine. And then it would be like on the cover of In Touch, like, Jessica's fine, says Ashley. It would be like the whole cover story. It was amazing.
Would you? And then you'd like be walking in New York and pass a newsstand when New York still had lots of newsstands and you'd see In Touch Weekly. And would you feel, be like, scoop?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. Yeah. No, I didn't really care at all. It was just like a weird way to... In fact, I didn't stand outside the Ritz. We got to... You know, go into the Ritz and expense martinis, and I could like bring a friend, and it was super fun, and they had all kinds of money. So I did that, and then I moved, and then I was like, it's time to like get serious and become like a serious magazine writer, like my ex-boyfriend, and kick his ass.
So you picked up the mic and went back to Philly.
So I went back to Philly for a year. Yeah.
What were those first stories that you were looking to do?
I don't know that I was really looking to do anything in particular, and I can't even remember what the first stories were. But I was kind of looking to learn.
I'm kind of glad to hear you say that because I couldn't find any of them.
Oh, good. Well, that's probably just as well.
So maybe you should just skip that shit.
I think I just wanted to learn how to do it. And it was a good place to learn without people seeing it, basically. to like work out, you know, the kind of messy mechanics of figuring out how to make a long story work. And it was super great because like Mo Tassick was there and Dan P. Lee was there. And
if you have not listened to the Dan P. Lee episode, you should listen to it.
Totally. Yes. So it was kind of fun to have those guys around. Dan and I had like windowless offices next to each other. And we just like talked all day about like, you know, how to make this story work. And like our stories were about like the local weatherman, like, right. You know, 3,000 word profile of the weatherman. But like we wanted to make them be like interesting. And
right.
Good.
Yeah. Putting as much effort as you possibly could into the weatherman.
Yes.
What were the kinks that you were working out?
I think just like kind of mechanics, like structure. And I mean, I'm still working out all of these kinks. I don't have any idea what I'm doing every time I sit down to write anything. But just figuring out the voice of how magazine writing was different from writing for an alt weekly or a newspaper or even In Touch Weekly. I didn't actually write anything for In Touch Weekly. Yeah, so just kind of figuring out, like, how to make that work and what my voice was.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things quickly and tell you a little bit about our sponsor this week. It's Warby Parker. We are huge fans of Warby's over here. They also sponsored the launch of the Longform app last month. You've downloaded the app, right? Free iPhone, iPad. Go get it. Anyway, we're huge fans of Warby's, and it's not just because their glasses look great, which they absolutely do. It's also not just because their glasses are affordable, which they most certainly are. Warby glasses start at just $95, actually. Here's another reason why we're such huge Warby fans. For every pair they sell, they give a pair to someone in need. So go get yourself some glasses. Go to warbyparker.com/longform. That's warbyparker.com/longform, and you'll get free expedited shipping. Warby lets you try any pair of glasses risk-free. It's super easy. They've got this home try-on program where you choose up to 5 pairs. They send them all to your house, and then you just pick the one or two that look best. You're good to go. Couldn't be easier. Get started now. warbyparker.com/longform. Buy a pair of great-looking glasses, and you'll also directly be helping our show. Thanks to Warby for its continued support of Longform. We really do appreciate it. Okay, let's get back to Jessica. You sort of started writing, and like pretty quickly you were writing in public. Is that right?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Like you were not keeping tons of journals in Prague and just started doing it. When you were writing for people.
Yeah.
That feels really different to me than a lot of writers, I think.
Yeah, probably.
Like when you're when you're writing a column, like a gossip column for an alt weekly, and then the magazine stuff, like you're thinking of an audience.
Totally, yeah. And I was like really like catering to the audience.
Yeah, I mean,
I think early on, especially.
How so?
Well, like I was saying with the like kind of wise assy stuff in the gossip column that I had for the alt weekly. I mean, Philadelphians like love that stuff. How do other people do it? What do they keep, little diaries and journals?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a strain of people who do this work who got into it because all they wanted to do was write, mm-hmm. and this was a way to get paid to do it, maybe, which is different than starting out and basically like the first things you're writing are being read by people and designed to be read by people.
Yeah.
Just start, like, I mean, I think everyone's pretty focused on their audience, and sometimes people say they're not, and I don't totally believe it, but it does orient you differently, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was a job. Like, it was how I
survived,
sort of. I remember calling my mom when I got the first job at Philadelphia Weekly, like, when they actually hired me from being an intern. I was like, I'm getting paid $25,000 a year.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? She was like, wait till you work out the math of that and then give me a call back.
No. Yeah, I had the same experience. I was living in Tampa, Florida, and I was like, who's going to pay for rent and like a bunch of beer? I'm golden. This is amazing. Right. All I have to do is write articles.
That's all you need.
It's incredible. Well, how did New York Magazine happen? How did you go?
Oh, yeah.
How did you go from working out the kinks in your windowless office next to Dan P. Lee to writing for New York Magazine and GQ? How'd that happen?
Right. So basically, and like, why, this kind of gets into why I'm like sensitive about the wise ass stuff, is that I really felt like that was kind of like foisted on me and by editors in Philadelphia, and the breaking point at Philadelphia Magazine was when the editors asked me to do like basically like a hit piece on Alex's Lemonade Stand, which, as you know, is like an organization that raises money for pediatric cancer. I just couldn't really do that.
What was the nature of the attack they had in mind?
I don't even know. I don't even know what they were thinking. I didn't even listen to the full idea, but I was like, it's time to go now. And Mo had already moved to New York and Motasic and had started at Jezebel. And she like heard about this job opening up at New York Magazine's website on the Daily Intelligencer site. And I was like, cool, I'll like try anything out. Or maybe it was AJ Delario, because he was in and out of Philadelphia Magazine as well. It's a weird time. Yeah, so I like sent in some clips and they hired me to do Daily Intel. And then I was on the blog.
Right.
Which was like a very weird place for me to be, because I'm not and have never been like a news person, like a news hound, like
right.
a breaking and
you,
news person.
Right, and you were on the like three posts a day. Like,
oh, like
written,
try
like
8 posts a day.
Yeah.
And we posted every half hour. It was just me and Chris Ravzar, and we posted like, we had to like aggregate the news, and it was every half hour like throwing something up there. We like barely got out of our pajamas. It was pretty intense.
And since then, you've been writing about Wall Street, and you started writing about startups for New York, and I definitely want to talk to you about that. And then also writing stuff for GQ.
Yeah.
Kind of this wide range of articles. Do you feel like there's any like through line between all those things? Is there like any kind of common theme? Like what are you looking for in a story?
I was thinking about this because I knew that you were going to ask it, but then I like sort of forgot to think about it. Think of an answer. I think that the through line with all of these things is that I really like hustlers. Like, I really like a story about like a person who like kind of like comes out of nowhere and like really tries to like do it for themselves.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I kind of think that maybe it's a quintessential New York Magazine story, and so it's kind of like a City Magazine story, and Philadelphia Magazine was, so it's almost like a reflex from City Magazines,
yeah.
Possibly. But also those people are just easy to like, kind of. Like, even when they're, you know, sort of terrible, they're easy to like.
Well, they're potentially easier to write about because they kind of inherently are selling themselves.
Well, that is true too.
Yeah, it's interesting now to hear you say that because I feel like Lloyd
Blankfein.
Blankfein. See, I was going to say Blankfein. That would have been wrong. In that story, very quickly, you like have him at a diner and have him making like Brooklyn one-liners, which kind of puts him in that context as well. Like I remembered that story a little differently, but then like reading your stuff kind of in a row, like it was very early on. It's like, this guy's the CEO of Goldman Sachs. He is worth bajillions of dollars. But you should not forget that like he's a kid from Brooklyn and he sits at a diner and he makes bad jokes.
Right.
And to get from there to here, there must have been some hustling along the line.
Oh, yeah. I haven't read that story since I wrote it because I feel like so confounded by him still. Like I still don't understand that trajectory totally. And I suspect that there's like, you know, daddy issues and all kinds of stuff like that. But I never really got it. I didn't have that much time with him.
That's a hard story.
Oh, yeah. And it was like anytime I made a call to anybody that was like, you know, out there, I'd get like a call from Goldman Sachs. It was like they were bugging my office. It was like anytime I called anyone to try to find out anything, they'd be like, hello, we know that you just called so-and-so. Like, it was kind of weird.
Also, you're wearing a blue shirt. Was that one you picked or when you were assigned?
I was assigned it, but I would have picked it if I wasn't assigned it.
I mean, because it's ambitious. Like, I mean, I'm surprised you even really got him to talk to you. Like, what is
he? He did not give any interviews after. It was the first interview he had given in about 2 years.
Yeah. Well, why? How'd you get him to do that?
I mean, I had been badgering him for 2 to 3 years. and part of the reason is probably that from being on the blog during the financial crisis, I sort of took on the Wall Street stuff because, I don't know, I was trying to like endear myself to my employers. And it became interesting to me, actually. I sort of found that the way that the narrative skewed was actually, this is a controversial statement, it was actually kind of unfair to Goldman Sachs. I mean,
you're a Goldman Sachs defender, is what you're telling me.
Not really. It's more like there were other players that were as bad, even worse. And we're seeing that now. But at the time, Goldman was getting all of the hatred. Like, there were stickers everywhere that said Goldman Sachs, and they were on Saturday Night Live, and it was really over the top, like how much fury was leveled on them as opposed to JP Morgan or Countrywide or, you know, any of the other terrible players in the mortgage, Deutsche Bank.
So is that part of your...
Like, Deutsche Bank just doesn't roll off the tongue as easily as Goldman Sachs.
There's no good, like, greedy Deutsche Bank puns.
Yeah, so...
So was that part of your pitch, kind of?
That was kind of part of my pitch. Like, how do you, like, from the eye of the storm, like... But, you know, I don't feel like I really got it. But that was what I wanted.
I'm interested in that pitching thing. How like, naked do you get with those pitches? Like, how clean do you come on your own motivations and... Like, how much are you selling people on doing a story?
Well, it depends on who the person is and something like that. That was definitely, like, an effort.
Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Like, a large effort. I mean, that's New York Magazine is not a natural outlet to give that interview to. I badgered them for a very, very, very long time.
That's a good lesson.
Yeah. And then I was like, you know, I'm going to do it anyway.
Right.
Which is a thing that... You have to say sometimes, I'm going to do like a write around on this. And then, you know, they kind of came through with giving me some time.
Okay, so that's one version.
Which isn't like a good message to put out there. You should threaten people by saying you're going to do it anyway. But right. I was in a position where that's what New York Magazine wanted me to do. And I don't particularly like doing write around. So, I mean, it's creepy, right? If somebody like wrote about it, I mean, I like them and I read them. But if somebody wrote a whole profile of you without ever talking to you.
So that's one end of the spectrum is like, how do you get the CEO of Goldman Sachs to give his first interview in 2 years? And the answer is basically like badger him and threaten him. But
but nicely, but politely.
But super politely. And like, right, very charmingly. And then how do you pitch the fine gentleman at Washio?
That didn't need to be pitched at all.
Right. Well, for context, you started writing about sort of Silicon Valley startups, and there's a couple pieces. There was the most recent one was Airbnb, but then there was one before that was about the various men, and they're all men, trying to disrupt laundry.
Mm-hmm.
And the leader in that very crowded space is Washio.
Right, with an app that you can order laundry picked up and delivered on your iPhone.
Uber for laundry.
Yes, Uber for laundry was the line that I heard a lot. So I wanted to do something that was like, you know, what it was like to like work at a startup, basically. And I had sort of like done like a story on Warby Parker that was, you know, kind of whatever. It was for a fashion issue. And the culture was intriguing a little bit. It's like so different, but not really. But
Which culture was different?
Just the culture of startups.
Yeah.
And office culture is quite different.
Than like magazines.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, certainly. Yeah, definitely from magazines. But from most office jobs, I think. I wanted to do something kind of like about like be inside of a startup a little bit. And I wanted like a fun, lighthearted startup.
Right.
I found these like laundry startups that there was multiple ones. There was a post about them on ValleyWag and about on TechCrunch. One of the things is that when I was looking for a startup, it was like the possibilities were like endless.
Right,
like it was just totally overwhelming. So I was taking
especially if you're looking for a you use the word fun, but also maybe like frivolous, like a little frivolous.
I wasn't really looking for something frivolous. Okay. I just didn't want it to be like a business, you know, like super like math oriented, like about coding, whatever, right. Like bored. I wanted it to be something comprehensible to the average person. I came across these laundry startups and there was more than one of them. But I was taking ages to like decide on like how to approach the story. Because I wanted it to be about the culture of these startups. And I thought that maybe we'd been taking it all a little bit too seriously from the outside. That, like, you know, actually it was hilarious, the words that they used and, like, the snacks in the office and just the whole, like, setup.
The Flax
pretty
Christini.
Funny. The Flax Christini. Yeah, the lingo, just, like, the super rah-rahness of it. We were all taking it really seriously. Like, it was, like... This is like we're changing the world. It's like, okay, they're changing
Who's
the world.
Who's we?
I kind of feel like the media was taking it quite seriously. I mean, not necessarily the culture, but like they would write about startups like they was, you know, normal.
Right.
There was like four laundry startups. Or so then Adam Moss is like, you have to decide on a startup, basically. And I called up Jordan at Washio, and he was like, so much fun to talk to on the phone. He was like a former child actor and he was super talkative. And I was like, I'm going to come out and see you like next week. And he was like, okay. So I went out there and hung out with them for a while. They're super nice people. They're like us, you know, they're just like us.
Startups,
like,
they're just
young
like us.
People in their 30s. Yeah, I mean, they're like really nice guys.
But using some pretty ridiculous lingo.
Yeah, it's absurd. I think they kind of know it's absurd.
Do you think they know it?
Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear you say that. After reading that article, I would not describe those guys as like super self-aware.
I mean, there's one moment in the article where Sam, who's one of the partners who started it, is talking about how they like to do this like charity drive where they bring your extra clothes to Goodwill for you. Because he's like, because it's so annoying when you're trying to bring clothes to Goodwill and then they stack up in your house. And then he's like, he sort of catches himself. He's like, it's not that annoying. It's just like a part of life. So I think there is some self-awareness there, but you do get kind of caught up in it and it becomes your normal.
Yeah. Yeah. There are several kind of like asides in that story and in some other stories of yours, I guess, that are kind of like, they're perfect, but they're biting, you know? Like there's one in there like where you describe someone, I forget which one of the guys it was, but you describe someone as like furring his bow or something in the style of someone who has not contemplated the fact that he will ever age.
But that's true. That's exactly how he said it. It's like, that's how all these people talk.
Well, I'm not doubting the veracity of the description. I said it's perfect.
Yeah.
But it's not the description of someone who's particularly like self-aware. Like, I'm sure that moment he was like, oh, fuck, I sound like such an asshole.
I'm not sure about that, actually.
What do you think their reaction is?
They liked it.
Really?
Yeah. They were really happy to get the publicity, I think, and then they got, like, $10 million in their next round of funding, so I guess it worked out.
You should get, a chunk of that.
I don't think so. But, that was, like, a kind of thing where, that just sort of needed to be in my opinion, like, that sort of needed to be, like, put out there that these people talk about old people as though, like, they're not going to be old people. And it's super weird and disrespectful. And it's, like, completely part of the culture. And this came up in the Airbnb story, too. It's
just people
are like, you're old.
Well, it also, I think it is particularly weird given the sort of rhetoric around we're, like, forever changing the world. And we're focused on a better future for everyone. Because it sort of undercuts that, because it's also like, also I can't see much past my 18-month runway, because that's all that actually matters to me.
One of the things that annoys me about the kind of change the world thing is that if you like kind of look at the actual fundamentals of the people who are running these companies, like they like went to Wharton and like Harvard, and just because they're wearing sneakers, like they're not any different really than like the man of yore. You know, like they're kind of like, they're pretty corporate.
Corporate? I don't know if corporate is the word I would use.
No, they are corporate. They are like backed by investors that are American Express,
right?
Venture capital funds. I mean, like, it's just kind of like it's a little bit wolf in sheep's clothing.
They're definitely still the man. I think it's just like that thing where it's like all the money was here. And now all the money's here.
Yeah.
But
the whole like pretense that they're like different and that they're like conscientious companies,
right,
and better to their employees because they keep snacks around. And really, that just keeps you in the office longer.
Right. Well, that whole thing about like
vacation, we have
the vacation policy thing is pretty incredible.
Yeah. That's like the apex of that.
Right. Yeah. We have no vacation policy and we encourage you to take as much as you want.
Right. So
or
you
none.
Never take it.
Exactly.
So that interests me a lot about those companies.
Right. So, I mean, but that's skepticism. Like, you went in skeptical.
Yeah, totally.
And your skepticism.
That was kind of the point, to be, like, skeptical.
Right.
Yeah.
And your skepticism was confirmed.
Yeah, pretty much.
So if you went in skeptical and your skepticism was confirmed,
mm-hmm,
and there are some kind of, like, zinger lines in there, why are those guys happy with that story?
I don't know. I kind of think that part of the culture is to be like shameless or to put on like with any amount of press that you can get. And I don't totally know why that is. And also just to kind of put on a happy face.
Right.
Be like,
well, yeah. I mean,
or also they can just be like, look at this big, long article about Washio. And like most people won't read it. And they'll just be like, wow, that's great, you guys. Congrats on your big, long article.
It's over 4,000 words.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I do think like shamelessness is a pretty important part of that job, that startup.
Of being like a founder of anything, for sure.
Yeah.
Like you, like you're a shameless long-form enthusiast.
I think I am a shameless long-form enthusiast.
Oh my God, I'm so uncomfortable. We're talking about you. You guys are like basically a startup.
No, but I...
We're in Dumbo in like a room full of startups. Like, I'm not going to be allowed to leave the room.
With a dog. But the...
You have snacks.
We have all kinds of hippie snacks if you want them. We have tons of hippie snacks.
But do you have Flax Christini?
We've had them.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh.
What the fuck is a Flax Christini? No, we have not had that. But we do have like a bunch of weird... hippie snacks, if you want any.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll stay away from your corporate.
We're definitely
snacks.
That thing. The like shameless part of it. I think is like the part of this that I'm the worst at. I carry deep shame.
Yeah, I'm trying to have less shame, but it's
How's
very
it going?
Hard.
Yeah,
no,
I'm trying
it's
to.
Very hard. That was a good question that you asked George Saunders. Is like, how do you learn to take compliments?
Yeah.
And I was that like, was a, that's coming from like a real Max Linsky place.
Because I'm just
getting trouble taking compliments.
I got in trouble for not taking a compliment. That was like the day before. It's not like I'm like constantly getting compliments. I should just point out.
Mm-hmm. It was a little bit humble braggy.
Due to the shame. That was like one compliment that I got in January. that was the compliment I got then that month. Anyway, yeah. Well, we can talk about my shame at a later date, maybe. This isn't the right.
It's a whole other podcast.
But there are shameless things we could talk about.
Uh-oh.
I know about some shameless things we could talk about.
Oh, no. This is where it takes a turn.
Let's talk about the stories that you write for GQ.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Those aren't shameful.
Well, the Adam Driver one was kind of shameful.
For Adam Driver or for you?
For me.
Why?
It was just not good.
What was embarrassing about it? I haven't even read it, so you can tell me about it because I can't even like talk about
it. I don't know
it.
If I can like properly articulate why it was embarrassing. I mean, it was just like he's an interesting guy, totally pleasant and nice and very into his work and it was just kind of like a nothing interview. And then I got home and I was like, shoot, what do I say about this guy? He's kind of like normal and kind of nice. And
did you write a piece that like he's a normal, nice guy?
I think so. I have no idea what happened. It was like all a blur. I went to like a fugue state and I wrote this thing. But I know that he sent me flowers afterwards, and that's never a good sign.
How come?
There should be something that bothers people about. If you truly did your job, then
they should be a little bit more uncomfortable.
They should be just a little bit like, because, you know, nobody's perfect.
Except for Adam Driver.
Except for Adam Driver.
How do you approach those celebrity profiles that you're doing for GQ? And do you turn any of them down?
Yeah.
This has sort of
been my year of yes, where I've said yes to a lot of things, including like Adam Driver, which I probably should have
really
said
like
no to. It
sounds really self-helpy.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. It's like a good like palate cleanser in between writing like long stories about business and and really like thinky things. It's fun to just like go to LA and spend like a few hours or days with a celebrity person. I don't really know if I have like a I actually don't have an approach. I don't like really have a plan. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't.
What's the time it worked
basically.
Out?
Basically. A time that I think Adam Levine kind of worked out. I just kind of showed up and we just like hung out for like a long time.
You wrote one about Channing Tatum.
Yeah, that worked out. That was fun. That was like definitely an experience of just being like, I'm just going to go with it and see what happens.
That one seemed like it got a lot of attention.
Well, yeah. So I spent the night in the desert with Channing Tatum on a whim. So there's always an activity with these celebrity profiles, which people think is like fake, and it is fake, but it's also like kind of great, like to have something to do with somebody that you don't know.
Like, right. Beats like sitting in a hotel room with like waters that you don't drink.
Yeah. So his idea was to go out to this bar in the desert outside of LA, like probably 2 hours outside of LA, that he had read about. It was in like a ghost town. And on the way there, it sort of turned out he was like, yeah, I brought my sleeping bag because I was thinking, like, I think he thought he was going to, like, kind of, like, ditch the interviewer and be like, I'm going to, like, camp out in the desert by myself because that's kind of what he's like. And or maybe his friend would come out and meet him. And I was like, I want to go camping in the desert. And so we sort of did that. But then we also made friends and they, like, let us stay at their friend's house. And it was this kind of, like, whole collision of hilarious events in this ghost town.
Right, involving a lot of tequila.
Yes.
Part of the reason that one got attention, I think, is because it just like broke that mold a little bit, you know? Like the knock on those kinds of pieces is that they're pretty formulaic.
Right.
And at least that one felt like you two did kind of go to the desert and get pretty drunk. And it was like a little weird, but mostly fun.
Yeah.
But there was also this like, I think Emma Carmichael wrote about it on Gawker afterwards. There was it fit with like the Edith Zimmerman piece on Chris Evans. There was this whole kind of conversation that started about men's magazines assigning women to go cover men.
Right. Well, that always struck me as sort of silly because men's magazines assign men to cover women all the time. And it's not that weird. It's not like, I don't think that they were like,
you don't think it's a thing?
Go flirt with them. Sweet. It wasn't like some, like, I can't even imagine like my editors at GQ like even having that, like that was just a silly. And also it was like, it was such like a palsy thing, like it didn't even occur. I think it's in the story, like at like one point he calls his wife and she's like, oh, it's kind of weird that you're in the desert with a girl. And he was like, oh yeah, like that is weird. It's like, oh yeah, well, let's go back inside and talk to our friend Ordinary Tom that we met at the bar. Also, by the way, the best part about that is that so we had this like kind of epic night, and it was like the easiest story I ever wrote because I just had to say what happened because it was like so much stuff happened and it was also super indicative of his personality. But then like probably a year or maybe even 2 years later, right before Magic Mike came out, I ran into Channing Tatum at Fet Sao in Brooklyn. And I was with a bunch of my friends, and he and his, like, friend came over and, like, bought us all drinks, and, like, we all hung out.
But no one went camping. You didn't, like, go camping in Prospect Park?
We didn't
Park.
Go camping in Prospect Park. But it was like, all right, Channing Tatum, my pal, in Brooklyn.
Where does that fall on the, like, getting flowers sent to you?
That's a different thing.
I have some more questions for you, and then we'll let you go.
Okay.
You were married to a journalist.
I was married to a journalist.
I did not get enough research done.
Really? I was, yeah.
Oh, no, it's okay.
I was married to Ben Wallace, who now works in New York Magazine. It's all good. We're friends. He also worked at Philadelphia Magazine.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, journalists shouldn't necessarily be married to each other.
Well, I got
to
tell you, that was an interesting, that's an interesting way for that to go, because what I was going to ask you was, how is it like to be married to a journalist?
Great guy, super great writer, not the boyfriend that I was talking about previously, just to make that totally clear. It's kind of weird. I'm glad you asked. Maybe it'll be good that it's like out there because nobody asked me about it, because everybody's like super weirded out that we work in the same office together.
How is that?
It's fine.
Really?
It's totally fine. I mean, it's not like we go to meetings or like, but yeah, we're pals. We're friends.
Do you guys like get lunch?
Sometimes.
Was both being in the same profession part of what went wrong?
Probably. A little bit. I mean, like, you have the same exact neuroses, basically, and
Well, also, like...
Let's get into the therapy portion of
Well, this is... Are
you married to a journalist?
No, I'm married to she teaches 8th grade special ed at a public school in Brooklyn. She's winning, like, all of the karma points for our household.
Yeah.
It's, like, pretty instant. There's a lot of days where I come home, and I'm like, you will not believe this thing that happened on the internet today. And she's like, today, a kid threw a chair at my head.
Oh, man.
And it's like, I'm going to shut the fuck up about the internet now. That doesn't matter at all. I sort of appreciate the fact that exactly that I can't go home every day and keep talking about the same shit mm-hmm. that I've been talking about all day at work.
Well, fortunately, I can, because I'm now married to a consultant who reads everything, but doesn't actually, like, you know, traffic in it. So he can, like, totally talk about it with you know, facility, but
well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, she can too. She's
right.
She's into it, but it's not like it's not occupying the same world.
Right.
So I guess the answer to that is that it's hard.
But no, I mean, like, a lot of my friends like kind of like only wanted to like date journalists. I mean, it's like it's really compelling to like be with somebody who like gets you and like gets how weird you are, and like that's why Ben and I are still friends, I think.
Yeah. Do you think it made you a better journalist?
Oh, totally. Oh, my God. Yeah, he was, like, so helpful to me. He's really good at what he does. And, yeah, especially when I was, like, kind of starting out. And yeah.
So would you advise other people to get in relationships with journalists?
No, I advise them against it, actually.
Would you advise people who do interviews with journalists to do better research before they ask them about their personal lives?
It's not like it's online. I mean, the New York Times doesn't do divorce announcements.
How much traffic would that section get if the New York Times started doing divorce announcements?
I think that there was, like, for like in the early days of blogs, there was a blog that was like breakups, and it was so great. I don't know if it was real, but it was hilarious. But no, I kind of think that they should definitely do that. Especially, I mean, with the internet, they have no excuse to not like update things.
It could be a page. Like Sunday Styles, it could be a page. It's like wedding, breakups. Wedding.
Right.
Yeah.
That kills the rest of your questions.
Sorry about that.
That's cool.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't kill my line of questions. It just makes me feel shame.
Well, you're good at that, so it's fine.
Thank you for the compliment.
You're welcome.
I have two more questions. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm interested in writing and the way that you actually write, because there are these turns of phrases, these like little images and stuff that get into your stories that I feel like are not in most magazine stories. This is going to be a very dudish one of me to pick out, but the story about Diana Passage,
mm-hmm.
you describe her as having a grapefruit tree figure, which I thought which I thought was pretty great. And then
I don't remember writing that. Okay.
And another thing that I noticed was that you use the word besotted a lot.
More than once?
Many times, actually, yeah. I think that is the word that you like fell for someone or was in love.
That is so weird. Wait, in the same story?
Different stories.
Because that would be a copy editor problem that I'd have to rage against copy.
No, different stories.
No. That's interesting. There's definitely words that I reuse over and over again. I didn't realize besotted was one of them. Definitely, like, the grapefruit tree. I mean, like, sometimes, like, stuff just pops into my head. I have no idea.
Yeah, does it just come to you? Or is it, like, is that something, like, or that line about the kid furrowing his brow, like, somebody who had never thought about himself aging. Like,
yeah.
Is that something that you put down in your notebook? Or does that come to you later? Does it come while you're writing?
I think it came while I was, like, writing the sentence. I mean, like, the, like, idea was there that, like, I was, like, man, these people talk about it like they're never going to get old. I mean, like,
right.
You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Those things aren't coming to you while you're reporting.
No, not at all. No. In fact, well, getting to the, like, wise-ass thing and how it bothers me a minute, I really like everybody that I'm interviewing in the moment that I'm interviewing them. Like, I like people. Like, I like all people. And I naturally like all people. And I record it. And then I go home and I transcribe it. And sometimes I'll be like, I really like this person, but, like, damn. Like, that is just, like, you shouldn't say that. Like, that's not good on paper. And then, and this is why the wise-ass thing bothers me. It's, like, kind of a struggle for me to let somebody say something, like, obtuse or, you know, even the Airbnb guys, like, I felt really bad because there's one part in that story where, like, he quotes Picasso. And it's like, no, Picasso didn't say that. Like, and I wasn't thinking in the moment, like, Picasso didn't say that. It was later I, like, Googled the quote and I was like, Picasso didn't say that. And it was like, oh, my God, these guys are, like, always quoting people. Like, and it's kind of like this, like, part of this culture. And I feel like it's, like, important to not let your liking for people impede, like, your kind of judgment on the situation.
Do you think that has the effect of people loosening up and opening up to you and then reading the story and feeling like they kind of got burned?
I really worry that that is the case. But, like, also, this doesn't happen all the time. Like, people will sometimes say to me, and they'll be like, I'd never let you interview me. And I'm like, that is like a, first of all, that's like, you should never say that to me or to any journalist, because that's like super rude.
Hold on, I'm just crossing off a question.
But also, it's like, I probably, like, 80% of people, like, are happy, not like sending flowers happy, but, like, you know, are fine and, like, feel like they've been hurt or whatever. And then some people are not happy, but I do think that, like, and the reason the wise-ass thing bothers me is that I do think that I try, and I don't know if it works, and maybe it doesn't, I try to, like, convey what it's like to be with the person and, like, to like them. So you kind of end up, I think, I'm hoping that you kind of end up liking this person even though they say these kind of obtuse things.
Liking them sort of in spite of themselves.
Yeah.
Do you think that you take them seriously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, okay, so taking that, like, Picasso quote as an example.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I would argue that, like, if you want to think about it, like, the HBO show Silicon Valley, which is what prompted you to write about this stuff, like, that could totally be a scene in that movie as some dude quoting Picasso. He wouldn't even have to get it wrong. Just the idea of quoting Picasso is sort of a suspect move.
Right.
The fact that the quote is wrong, for sure, it's super telling, but it undermines some credibility of a person who's running a $10 billion company.
Well, as it should.
It has the
not to say, like, if you can't quote Picasso correctly, you shouldn't be running a $10 billion company. But,
I mean, a good rule of thumb is if you can't.
The point is, I mean, I think kind of overall is that these are kids. These are, like, this is the world that we live in. Like, that people are walking around, like, you know, being like, George Bernard Shaw said that, like, I should disrupt the world. Like, fuck everybody. You know, like, that's kind of their, like, scene. And I'm sure that he expected that, you know, when he said that I would write something like, Picasso said creativity comes from constraints. He said, like, staring into the middle distance of the restaurant that he, like, you know, founded his company at 7 years ago. And, like, the fact that people are used to being reported on like that is kind of fucked up. And, like, I kind of want to, like, you know, call attention to that in some way. Like, just be like, wait a minute, hold on, stop the presses. This is, like, complete bullshit what you're saying to me right now. And because this is bullshit, I don't know what else is bullshit.
Okay. What you're offering there is actually, like, a critique of his hustling practices. Like, he's not. What that
his
is
hustle
like,
is bad. He has a bad hustle.
He has a bad hustle. He has a $10 billion hustle, but it's kind of like there are holes in his hustle.
That's funny.
That's
probably true.
Because I was thinking, like,
I'm a crisis PR person. Like, in a.
Well, it's funny because, like, I read that story and I'm like, it seems like you don't take those guys super seriously. But in fact, they have to be taken seriously because they have sort of stumbled in a way into this thing that's now worth massive amounts of money and taking up like lots of public funds and figuring out how to deal with. They have to sort of be reckoned with. And what you seem interested in is finding the holes in that hustle to sort of point out that it's not all quite as earnest and above board as it seems.
Well, yeah.
Or straight ahead.
Yeah. And I think that's, it's not like even like, oh, your PR is bad. It's like that's the story. Is that like
it's not
this
a PR
company
thing
is like we're really
Picasso.
Great for the world, and it's like, are you great for the world? Like, I don't know. Maybe there's like a bunch of underlying problems here that we should like take a look at. And part of it is just like, I just don't want to like live in a world where these things like totally slide by, and I want to like be able to call attention to them in a not boring way.
right. Because, I mean, that's true.
Like, I mean, it's funny. It's funny.
It's the
also,
stories are entertaining.
It is legit. No, but it's legitimately funny that we live in a world where, like, a pair of 30-year-old art students can start a company, like, out of their bedroom that is, like, this kind of kooky idea of, like, sharing room. And it becomes, I'm saying $10 billion. I don't know if that's the correct figure, but a $10 billion company. And it's, like, meanwhile, the New York Times is worth, like, $1 million. It's like, what? I don't even know. It's funny, sad. It's funny, tragic. It's weird. It's like a weird time to live. I don't know what it means or anything, but it's super weird. And we should just like kind of get out of the. I feel like it's like get out of the like narrative of like people are changing the world or like, you know, I don't know. I kind of think that maybe the jokes or like I use the. Humor. I'm trying to use the humor to like kind of shake up how seriously like we've been taking things or you know, call attention to the fact that maybe we should be paying attention to different things. I don't know.
I think that I misread those stories.
Well, people can't read. I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, I only read the first paragraph, but no, I think I misread those stories. I think the question I wanted to ask you after reading
I miswrote them.
No, that's not where I'm headed. This is my shame, Jessica. This is my shame.
Don't try to outshame me.
It's my shame we're talking about here. No, the thing is, like, the last question I was going to ask you was like, it doesn't seem like you take this stuff very seriously. What do you take seriously? What do you think you'll be writing about in the future? Like, is there something that you don't kind of have to like joke your way through because you kind of don't take it super seriously? And I think what you just said is this is super serious. This is like very important. And these guys are kind of getting a pass.
Yeah, no, that is exactly what I'm saying. And like, it's kind of like if you have to tell people that story or if you have to make people laugh to tell them that story, like, yeah, it's a. I think that people, this is like kind of tuning my own horn in my new, our new plan of not being shameful. But like, I think that was an issue where it had been written about in like a pretty dry way. Like the conflict had been written about in a very dry way, and people were not really grasping what was going on. And I think if you can put it in like a way that has like color and humor and like, you know. Characters, then it makes it more useful. It makes it easier to understand what's going on.
And it makes it easier to see like where the hustle is and who's hustling.
Yeah, and everybody's hustling. And I think that's kind of like what the end of the story is. It's just like everybody has a different hustle going on.
So what's your hustle?
I have no hustle. I have no game. I don't know. I don't have one. I'm still bumbling through. I'm still bumbling through everything.
It's a classic hustler line.
Yeah, no, I seriously have no idea what I'm doing. None.
That seems like a good place to end it. Jessica, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Rachel Mabe. Thanks very much to my guest, Jessica Pressler, for taking the time. Aside from that one moment where I felt absolutely awful, I had a really wonderful time talking to her. Go read her work. It's excellent. It'll make you laugh. Thanks to our sponsors, Tiny Letter and Warby Parker. Go to warbyparker.com/longform. You'll get free expedited shipping on your next pair of great-looking glasses. We'll see you next week. That's the time you get me running, and you know I'll